Mr. Carter, reel 15. You'd been training for D-Day up in Scotland, and a variety of training up there, which we've already mentioned. Where did you move to when you left Scotland?
Well, we came down by the train, and as you know, I had this helmet with this big hole in, and I was hoping to come down the eastern side, because that would pass my grandfather's farm, and my idea was to throw this helmet out with a message in it, so they'd know where I was. Most likely asking, you know, do you think this man's still alive who wore this helmet? But we came down the western side, that's Carlisle and the, all the top that way, and we were on the way to Boscombe, down in Hampshire. We got past London, and there were some American vehicles on the road. We were going under this bridge, and one landed on top of the carriage. Luckily, we were only going, the train was only going slow. Anyway, we carried on, and we got to Boscombe, and we went into a big hotel. Call it the Burlington Bertie, I call it. And we were billeted in there. And I mounted my first guard there. It was only like a token guard, three men and myself. And I was waiting for relief to come. Our time was up. And none was coming, so I dismissed the three men. Then Ollis turned up and he said, "Where's the guard?" I said, "I've dismissed them." "Oh," he said, "you shouldn't have done that." At any rate, he must have squared it with the ordinary officer. I never heard no more. From there, we did some more invasion training. We did one to Studland Bay, and it was a disaster.
What was the that particular one? What did you do?
With the landing craft, landing on the beaches and practicing going forward. And this one was a disaster at Studland Bay, because the reserve companies landed first, and the other companies landed in the wrong positions. Anyway, the next one we did was on Aileen Island.
Before we come to that one, can we look at some of the other kind of training that you were probably doing? You mentioned the fact that with mines you were learning to use mine detectors.
Yeah.
Did you also learn to pick mines by prodding with the bayonet? Was that part of your training?
No, we just had these here mine detectors, and that was towards D-Day that we got training on them.
Had you had the opportunity at this point to do any training taking over houses or fighting in houses?
No, we did none of that.
You hadn't done any of that?
No.
Had you done any training of a kind of commando type training, unarmed combat, hand to hand fighting?
No, we did none of that. It was all pursuing to land. That was our main purpose, to land and take over.
So your main training was being taken out to sea and then coming in as a field
pilot? Yes.
Had you, at this point, did you know that you were now part of an assault division?
No, I didn't actually know, no. We just took it for granted it was part of training. We didn't know we were going to be the assault division, although we knew they'd brought 50 div back for some purpose, right? Because it was a very well-trained division.
As 50 div had come back hoping, I think, that they wouldn't be the assault division, and I think it must have upset some of the regulars the regular members of the division who fought through 3 or X years of fighting and so forth to find themselves at the front line in the front line again.
No, none of that.
You didn't have any of that?
No, not that at all, no.
There weren't men going on leave and overstaying their leave. I'm thinking of men who'd been fighting in the Middle East and so on.
Well, my sergeant went on leave, I know that. He was a devil for wrestling with us. He belonged to Cleveland, and when he came back, he started wrestling. He must have had a rare time because I was able to hold him down.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Sergeant Hill.
And he was your platoon sergeant, was he?
He was a section sergeant.
Can we have a look at some of the weapons before we move on to the final training that you had before D-Day? We've talked about, obviously, rifles and Bren guns and so forth. Was the Sten gun, was it now a major weapon with you?
Yes, I had a Sten gun.
Did you like?
Commanders had Sten guns and sergeants had Sten guns.
Did you like it?
Well, it was better than a rifle, I think. But that's how it was. It was dished out to sergeants and NCOs, Sten guns. In fact, I had one that had a silencer on it. But they took it away from me. I don't know what for them, but they had another one.
Had it any faults?
Anyone?
Had it any faults as a weapon?
No, I don't think so. No.
Some people say that it, if you dropped it or caught it in certain situations, it would go off.
Well, it did.
Automatically.
It did, yes. Yes.
Which could be quite disconcerting.
Yes, it did cause one casualty, which I'll refer to later.
Grenades. Were you well trained in the throwing of grenades?
Oh, grenades, yes. And landmines as well.
What types of grenades were you issued with?
Mills. The old one, you know, the Mills. There was so many of them allotted to a platoon.
Flamethrowers, were they in with you at all?
I'll come to them later.
I know you mentioned that obviously artillery were taking part in your training because you had a narrow squeak with artillery. Did you train with tanks and infantry tank support?
No.
You hadn't done any of that?
No.
And did any air support come into your training?
No, I didn't.
You mentioned training from landing craft. Was there a drill for getting onto and off a landing craft?
Yes, you were allotted your places and you kept to them places all the time. And the drill was the same, like you got off in rotation. Say the assault section went out first, followed by the other sections.
So the assault section would be last run on and first run off. Is that how it worked?
Well, it wouldn't matter so much, like. I think we all went on and we took our places, you see. But coming off, yes, there was a sequence of coming off.
Can you describe a landing craft assault?
Well, yes, you're sat in three rows. And the middle row is the assault section. The front would be the officer and the sergeants. They'd be at front with the sections. Me being second in command was at the back of our section. And the second in commands will be at the back of the other sections, such as the Lance Corporals, same as I was then.
So it was like a box with a lid off the top, because it's the four sided. Vehicle.
You couldn't see all of it, you know, as you were sat down and you didn't see anything.
Where was it guided from or driven from? The naval personnel that drove it?
Oh, there were Royal Marines and they were with us all the time.
Same ones, right through?
Same ones every time, yes. Stuck to us, yes.
So you're training with the boat and the crew that.
Same one, yes, all the way through, yes.
And you get to know them quite well?
Well, a bit of time we were with them, right? They weren't that long, they were just in and out and away.
How large a crew did the craft have?
We didn't have a large crew, two or three marines, that's the point of all. Because you only need one to drive it, you got somebody at the front to drop the door, you know, so when you went out.
In the field training element of your pre-D-Day training, what was that based on? Was it still lines with the rifles held at port as you advanced? Or did you move in some other formation, some other way? Advancing on an objective, I'm talking about.
Well, I wouldn't say about that, because we just advanced with our, as we were, with our rifles and that, carrying them.
Was it fire and movement I'm thinking of?
Not much on D-Day, no. No. You had your objectives to take and you took them.
Was there opportunity for leadership initiative given to the lower ranks in case the senior ranks were knocked out?
Yes, that's why I was picked.
And how was that done? How would they do that if you were in a training situation?
Well, you come up to in my case, they were all knocked out. Except the officer, and as we landed, he said to me, "You're now platoon sergeant." That was that.
Was this the training situation?
No, this is when
we'll come to that. Yes.
Passing on.
Yeah, we'll come to that. What is the role of a lance corporal in a section?
Well, it's to take over if the sergeant's keen man takes over the section. You've always got to have a second in command, same as you have a second in command officer, don't you? He takes over the regiment if the CO's not there.
So you came down to the south and you went into obviously much more serious and wide scale landing training and so forth. You were going to mention the second one, Hayling Island. What did you do there?
Oh, we landed from the sea onto Hayling Island. And funny enough, there was a lot of WAFs there, stationed up there. And one came out and she said, what's all the noise about? I wish I'd told her we were Germans and we couldn't be taken prisoners. It might have shook her a bit. But we weren't long there when we moved again.
And where did you move to?
We moved to Winchester. I mean, it was getting warmer. I think it would be about February when we were down in Boston. It was warming up then. But we moved up to Winchester and we were in a big open space and tents. We were a bit static there, I think. And the sergeant went on leave somewhere. That's where I'd tussle with him when he came back from leave. And one Saturday, I had a brother who was in the engineers and I'd been trying to trace him for a long time. I knew he was around somewhere, so this Saturday afternoon, with one of the lads I piled up with, we went round the camps, into the canteens, and asking for the 69th engineers. Funny enough, we have a 69th brigade in our division, so it was easy to remember. And after a bit, we did find out where he was. He was down in Southampton. So down to Southampton we went, and I found him, and we went for a drink. We had a nice talk. And funny enough, in our family, sorry is not a word spoken much. And he said to me, he said, I'll always remember this, he says, Alan, he said, I'm sorry I didn't write to you all the time you were in India. But he said, now I'm in this position, he says, I've found out what a letter means. So that was quite a nice thing to say. And after that...
Did he survive the war?
He did survive the war, yes. I had another brother in the Durham, so there was, as I said, three at the beginning, comes in. There was three brothers on the Normandy front.
What were you doing at Winchester? You said that you're in a large tented camp.
I think we were just waiting for the next move.
Was it here?
We were more or less static.
Was it here that you were confined to camp and you weren't allowed out?
No, it hadn't happened then. But I can't give you these events in street sequence. It happened so fast. It may have been before. But we did get 10 days leave. I don't know when it was. Then we came back.
Did you know this was your embarkation leave in effect?
No.
I hadn't told you that yet.
No, they hadn't told us that. And we moved again, I think we would go down to again Romani in the woods there. Now this was getting near to D-Day. And they did give us a weekend, 48. And I thought it was too far to go home, although my brother did go home on his 48 because he was married. I wasn't. I went to a place called Belper in Derbyshire. I had an uncle there. And there was another lad lived there, so we went together. And I stayed with my uncle. He'd been in the First World War. He'd been a policeman. Of course, he was retired, but they called him back up for policing. And I was walking with him in the blackout down in Belper. And he kept saying, when he heard footsteps, he would shout across, "Good night!" And he'd get the word back, "Good night!" And he did that a few times, and I got curious. I said, "Why do you shout good night to him all this time?" He said, "I know the voices," he said. He said, "And if they don't shout good night to me," he said, "I'm straight across there to see who they are." Now that was policing in them days. And then there was a lot of black Americans. And they could never get it right in Belper that when they parked the vans, the buses and that, it was so many days on the right hand side and so many days on the left. And he said, "I used to go down and they'd be wrong." He said, "I just had to poke my head in the pub and they'd shout, 'Wrong side, boss.'" And he said, "Yes," and out they'd come and shift the vans. So, any rate, it got time to go back, and he got us a taxi because we had to catch a train at Derby. And we just scrambled back, and Hollis met us. He said, "I've been waiting of you two." He said, "The RSM's been shouting for his report." He says, "And I've been putting him off to see who would have reported us absent." So that's the kind of bloke Hollis was like. He kept us clear.
You were in Hollis's company, were you?
Oh, yes, I was in his company, yes, every time.
And was it this the time that you were, in effect, fastened into a camp and guarded, about not allowed out?
This would be after we got our 48. Yes, it was sealed then, we were sealed in.
Had you had any visits from important people up to now?
Yes, we did have the... We were in camp somewhere, and they said, "Right, line up at either side, you know, in two lines, the king's coming." And of course, I said, "Which king?" Because I thought it might happen in Norway, because he's our king, you see. No, but evidently it was King George, and he just walked down. I think he was looking for somebody with medals up, you see. He was looking, and as they do, look for somebody with a medal up, you know, DCM or MM. We had one DCM there, Armstrong. We called him Armstrong from up in Durham, he was.
Did Montgomery or Eisenhower come to talk to you?
No.
You didn't see them at all?
You saw the king.
Once you got sealed in, you would know then that this was what was coming.
yes, we knew that. But I still went to see my brother, and we met and we had a drink, and then I had to find my way back, and I'd forgotten the way. And some Canadians were going back in a truck, and they took me so far and said, "50 did down there." Well, I was walking and walking. It was a lovely night. I was walking and walking. I thought, well, I'll never get back before dawn at this rate. So I went round the back of the house and I got a bike and I biked back. But I'll always remember that night, because in that woods there was a nightingale singing. It was lovely. A lovely moonlight nightingale was singing his heart out to this nightingale. And I got back to the camp. Lads were in tents. And I woke them up. I said, listen to that. I didn't think they really appreciated it.
In the final stages of prior to D-Day in this camp, we're now being lectured or talked to on what was about to happen and what was expected of you?
No. The final stage, we were all called, NCOs were called to go to a demonstration. I know there was the Hampshire's NCOs and there was our NCOs. And we were to be given a demonstration of this crock that fired the fire, which we could call up to, you know, for support. And on the way, we passed a tank. And our officer said to me, to us like, he said, he said, did you notice anything different about that tank? Of course, we never noticed any difference. And it was one of them that went underwater. It had
the DD tanks.
DD tanks. That was the decision. I think he said, you sworn to secrecy, you're not to mention all this, you see. And while we were having this demonstration, one of the Hampshire sergeants, he shouted across to some of our sergeants and pointed at me. And this Hampshire sergeant turned out to be the one who, at the beginning, when I joined up, came to see me in the reception room at the depot it was in. And he said, do you know our lad in the 2nd Battalion? He said, you've just come from the 2nd Battalion, haven't you? I said, yes, I know him very well, Corrigan. Oh. And it's funny how it turned out that it was him, like. And later on, after the war, I met this Corrigan. I said, I met your lad at just before D-Day. I said, how did he get on? He said he was killed on D-Day. At any rate, we did demonstrations then with the mine detectors. You have to put the things on and practice with that. As I've told you, we practiced with the torpedoes, the bungalow torpedoes, because that was my section's duty to. They all carried one, and he carried the detonators in the sergeant. We joined them together and pushed them under the wire, and he fired them. And that was mostly our job. That.
Can you describe the torpedo?
There'd be about a 3-foot tube, and it all joined together. Till you got a good length, maybe about 6 foot, you could shove it under the wire. And the sergeant had the detonator, he pushed it in and then fired it. Yeah, it fired upwards, so you were safe enough, you see, that it was to cut the wire. Because during the war, the First World War, the artillery could never, and much of the fire could break the wire. That caused another casualty, but this must have been a new invention. They found out the blast upwards and cut the wire.
Bangalore, the name would seem to be associated with India.
It was, yes.
Was it effective?
Well, actually, we never used it.
At what point did they show you?
They did use it. We didn't, but it would be used at other places where there was a lot of wire. Yes.
In the final stages, were you shown plans and sand tables of...
That was on the boat.
That was on the boat as you were going over.
Yes.
Oh, we can come to that then. Now, most of your training, and if not all of it, had been done with live ammunition, had it not? You know, we were fired at with actual, the real stuff.
Up in Scotland, it was with live ammunition, yes.
And I think you meant...
From the artillery.
And there were casualties, which you were a close one at one time.
There was one in front of that, in front of his shoulder, and I was nearly dead.
Had you any thought at this time about what you may be going into?
No, we had no idea at all, like, what was going to be. We knew that we were in for it if we went to Cali, straight across there, you know.
Because you didn't know where you were going.
We didn't have no idea. But we didn't divulge till we actually got on the boat.
What was the morale of the battalion like?
Well, good. Yeah, this sergeant of mine was raring to go. He was a right one, he was.
Who was commanding the battalion?
He was Colonel Hastings.
Was he a young man?
He was a young man, yes. He'd been through the... I think we'd lost our CO of one of the battalions in the desert. And he'd come from another regiment and taken over. It was rather strange, like, that his name was Hastings, because William the Conqueror came from Normandy and conquered us at Hastings, and he was Colonel Hastings going over to Normandy to liberate Normandy.
What was he like?
He was a nice fella. He used to take us on lectures. And they could tell us where every regiment was and give you the worldwide situation, which kept you up to date, you know, what was happening all over.
Was he a hard training man? He worked you hard?
No, he wasn't a hard training man, no. He was a down-to-earth man. He was all right. Yeah.
Was he well-liked throughout the battalion?
Well, I liked him. I don't know if others did, because knowing Normandy, he was always up in front with us with his shirt hanging out, wasn't that? You know, his shirt's hanging out started on the front here, you know, in India. We started that off with our shirts hanging out. We also carried our rifles on our shoulders like that when we ran down. We didn't have them slung. We had them caught by the muzzle and...
Over your top of your shoulder.
That seemed to balance you as you ran down. Mm.
These were traditions then of the regiment, really.
Yes.
Do you remember the second in command?
Yes. Yes, he was. Let's see. Oh, he'd been one of our officers in the second battalion. He was a young chap. And. At Winchester, they said he had an accident, and but some say he committed suicide, so we lost him. But I don't know who came a second after that. I couldn't say. I was thinking of our second in command. Actually, I didn't know.
The adjutant?
No, I couldn't remember the adjutant.
And Major Lofthouse was your company commander, wasn't he? Which we've spoken about already.
Yes.
And Kirkpatrick was your platoon commander, is that right?
Yes, Lieutenant Kirkpatrick. Yes.
And I think this would be 16 platoon, was it? I think Kirkpatrick was in 16 platoon, according to the books.
Well, it would be 16, yes.
The men that were in your own unit, were there any characters amongst them?
Oh yes, there was one from Liverpool. He used to do the American twang, you know, imitate them, or they went for the girls, and he was good at that from Liverpool.
Had you met Americans at this time, this period of time, pre-D-Day?
No, never met the Americans. I only met them in Bombay, that's all. I met the Americans, just Americans. Yeah.